Good morning, everyone. Thank you for joining us at this hour on a surprisingly cold day for New Orleans. Anyways, as Judy and Jen have both referenced, I'm going to be talking about what it's like to use some of the core supported and developed tools in the field. And I have no disclosures. So this is just a quick overview of what I'm going to be looking at. We've selected three of our large programs in our portfolio, specifically for what we've done using some of these tools. A quick overview of ADRA, the Adventist Development and Relief Agency. We are the humanitarian arm of the Seventh-day Adventist Church, and we have programs in about 120 countries around the world, and you can see our key sectors. Obviously, today I'm going to be focusing on the health and nutrition aspects. So the first program that I am going to be talking about is one that has ended in South Sudan, called the South Sudan Health, Nutrition, and Empowerment Program, or SHINE, as we refer to it. And this is a program funded by USAID over a two-year period from mid-2010 to about mid-2012. And the focus of this program was on women of reproductive age, pregnant and lactating women, and children under five. And the main objective was to reduce malnutrition and decrease the prevalence of illness. So what I have up here is some of the context of what it was going in. So this is before the program, with fairly high stunting rates, underweight, breastfeeding was not happening as it should, suboptimal nutrition during pregnancy, which we know, of course, has a negative impact on the child, and limited access to health care. South Sudan was a very difficult context to implement in, high food insecurity, health insecurity, a lot of returnees, a very transient and kind of changing and very complex environment. And this is kind of what we were going up against. So, you know, designing this program, trying to decide, okay, well, how do we make a change in this situation? What do we do? So we use the care group model. As Jen referenced, it is a system of promotion, basically using leader mothers, neighbor women, health promoters to focus on some of these behavior change aspects. So basically within a community, there would be a leader mother who would be responsible for visiting 10 to 12 households, kind of her neighbors, and sharing with them what she was able to learn from the program, focusing on infant and young child feeding, breastfeeding, when to introduce complementary foods, her own health during pregnancy, and some of these different aspects to address the, you know, the context issues that the health situation that was there on the ground. In designing this program, bringing in the core group, we relied heavily on the care group manual, which was developed, I don't even know when, but it's so well used in our office, it feels like it's been a long time that we've been using that approach. And we wanted to use the care groups also for the social support aspect, so it's definitely a mechanism for the behavior change, but given the context, we knew that that social support was going to be needed. And one of the great things about having core group and having the manual there is that we can then reference what our colleagues have done and what the successes have been and how it works in some of these different contexts. And one of the notes that I wrote here, care groups are an excellent example of the genius that is brought together in core groups. So that was very helpful for us. So at the end of the program, after about 2 years, these are the results that we were able to achieve. And a lot of it, in my opinion, is highly attributable to using kind of the care group model and that peer relationship model, the social support, because rather than just having someone from a different community or a city or a different country or a different area saying, oh, you need to do this, it really gets at kind of bringing in the social behavior change, the what's going on in that community, in that household, because it could be very different from the community that's just a few kilometers down the road, and it's really able to use that, you know, this is my peer, this is my neighbor. And so we did do a lot of training and proper feeding, focusing on the women, but also focusing on the men and trying to get the men more, sensitized at least to the health and nutrition situation so that they can support or promote or participate directly. So this is the impact that we are proud to say that we were able to achieve through this program. The next program, strengthening and accessing livelihood opportunities for household impact, or as we just refer to it as SALUI, in Madagascar. Also a USAID-funded program. This is a five-year program that just ended in June of this year. And for those of you who don't know about Madagascar, it is quite the anomaly. It is a beautiful country, and in some of the places that I visited, seemingly quite fertile. Like, there are definitely lots of vegetables and greens available in the marketplace, yet you have this huge rate of stunting, of the chronic malnutrition, 15th highest stunting rate globally. So going in, this is kind of the situation that we were up against. High stunting, high rates of underweight, a lower percentage of children who are immediately breastfed, let alone exclusively and continuously breastfed. And then also, of course, this cycle that you have where the women themselves are undernourished, or, you know, they themselves were stunted, and it just kind of perpetuates and perpetuates. But, you know, looking at these programs on the food security side, you can see the food availability, the food access, and then the utilization. So it was clear to us that in Madagascar, while of course you can increase the productivity and the quality of the foods that are available and the income to afford it, there's a significant issue on the utilization side. But no one knows what it is. So you can go and you can ask UNICEF, you can ask USAID, you can ask other organizations, why is stunting so high? There is no definitive answer. So what do? You research it. So we did a local determinants of malnutrition study, which focuses on understanding the actual behaviors that go into the malnutrition. So I'm not quite the expert in SBC, but it's similar to a barrier analysis in that it's looking at doers and non-doers, but it's less on the barrier and more on the actual behavior. Excuse me. So what we did was trying to understand babies who were not breastfed, babies who were healthy versus babies who were not healthy. So looking at some of that positive deviance factors in what made the difference. So some of the factors we saw: perception of the child's size. Did when the baby was born, did they think that it was a small baby or normal? And when you have a situation with the stunting that's so high, it becomes very normalized. So they don't even realize that they're abnormally small. So that was one thing. Of course, the maternal health and nutrition aspect and the timing of complementary foods. I remember asking someone why boy children had complementary foods introduced sooner, and they said, oh, well, we have to give them their rice so that they grow strong. And in reality, it kind of had the opposite effect. So some of those little aspects like that. Some of the other things that we learned through this study was that women will fast before, like when it gets closer to the end of their pregnancy, because they don't want to have too big of a baby. They don't want to make their delivery too difficult. Consumption of alcohol is very high. Also giving young children alcohol when they're fussy or crying. And then these different taboos. So during pregnancy and breastfeeding, no cold water, no sweet potato, no fish, no citrus fruits or cucumbers or tomatoes. So it's these little things that don't necessarily make sense, quote unquote, from our perspective, but are very deeply ingrained in how they go about every day. So that was definitely something that was interesting to us. So in learning some of these things, we're able to tweak the messages that were delivered through a similar peer support, Sambaika, mother support groups, focusing on some of the key things that we identified, the water aspect, family, the breastfeeding and the weaning, and then working within the cultural constraints. So at the end of the 5 years, these are the results that we were able to achieve. And also the exciting aspect for us on ADRA's side is that we're having a follow-on program starting now that's able to build on what we found here and do some additional research. We're going to be doing the barrier analysis and the DBC and really trying to strengthen that aspect. The last example that I have for you is Jenga 2. I do not want to pronounce to you what Jenga means in Swahili, so we're just going to stick with Jenga 2. This is also a program funded by USAID 5-year program. We just finished the midterm evaluation, so we don't quite have the final impact, but this is kind of where we are now. This is the context. Also, high malnutrition, agriculture productivity has declined, lots of displacement, malnutrition among women is high, and a lot of reliance on the market to purchase food. In this situation, we did a barrier analysis to figure out what the behavioral determinants are associated with the particular behavior. So two of the ones that we looked at were food diversity and meal frequency, because we identified those as being major issues. So this was kind of the objective of doing the analysis, designing the communication strategy, identifying the constraints. We'll just stay on this one. And so what we found were, going back to the different behaviors that Jen had pointed out, but self-efficacy, positive consequences, cues for action, those are some of the ones that were significant for food diversity, and particularly being able to afford it, having their own household garden were also significant issues. And then for doers with the food diversity, interestingly enough, they were more interested in it for the cognitive development for the children, whereas the non-doers were a little bit skeptical about the disease prevention side of things. So it's pretty interesting. It's not always something that's expected, which kind of goes back to why it's so valuable to do these kinds of studies. So that's that. Sorry that it's so brief. Feel free to ask questions. But just in conclusion, what ADRA has gained from being part of Core Group and having access to not only the tools, but the people who've developed the tools and who have used them, has been invaluable. It is a space for the innovation and the creativity, the evidence that's there, the lessons learned, and the best practices that we at ADRA really feel have strengthened our programs, and hopefully our use of them will also contribute to the strength and the impact of some of the other programs. So there you have it.